Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of Beyond the Cover, hosted by myself, John Robb, and Jeff Ayers. Jeff, how are you doing tonight?
Doing fantastic. Hope you had a nice Thanksgiving.
Yes, you too, and a happy Thanksgiving to everyone else out there. Have a nice, safe holiday season as you go through the month of December. We have an extremely great show tonight, packed here with two guests. First, we're going to have number one New York Times bestselling author James Rollins talking about his latest book, which comes out in 2 weeks, The Bone Labyrinth, and that is another Sigma Force novel. And then we are going to have Douglas Schofield coming on later in the second half of the show. So jam-packed, and it's ready to go. So are you ready, Jeff?
Let's go for it.
Well, so without any further ado, let's get him on right now. Again, he is the number one New York Times best-selling author of his Sigma Force novels, of course, with several other standalone books, and he just had a trilogy finished with Rebecca Cantrell. So, Jim Rollins, we want to thank you so much for coming on. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks, John. Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you.
So let's just jump right into it. The Bone Labyrinth comes out in 2 weeks from tomorrow, so December 15th. So if people are listening to this show before that, they can mark down their calendar. December 15th is when the book launches. Why don't you give everybody a little bit of taste of what they can expect here and maybe kind of lead them up into the series of how you go along with the new Sigma Force series?
Okay. Well, this new installation of the Sigma Force series begins with the starts with two twin sisters. They're both geneticists, and they're attacked on two different continents. One is assaulted at a research dig in Croatia. The other is abducted from a primate research center outside of Atlanta. And Sigma's called in to rescue and protect these two women while exposing a plot that's tied to the Chinese government, where they're attempting to genetically engineer a hybrid species of human. But, of course, you know, me, with my Sigma story is always a lot more. It's a big continent-hopping adventure. The novel sort of explores the roots of human intelligence, exploring, you know, who we are and where we're headed next.
Could you talk about one of the new characters you introduce in this novel, Bako? Is that how it's pronounced?
Bako, yep, that's the way I pronounce it.
Talk a bit about him.
Well, Bako is a research animal. I don't know how much I want to give away necessarily of his unique nature. Me being a veterinarian, I always like to explore introducing unusual animals in my books, and especially when I get a chance to write from the those animals' point of view. So Bako is a three-year-old Western Mountain Gorilla, yet he's got a couple little surprises built into his genetic code. And so it was a great deal of fun sort of researching, you know, how intelligent are gorillas, what can they do, what can't they do, how do they sort of view the world, how would they experience the world, because I wanted to be able to write scenes through the eyes of Bako and sort of bring the reader into this sort of unique type of creature and, you know, hopefully, you know, put them in the paws of that Western Mountain Gorilla.
Well, you actually sort of addressed a follow-up question I had for you. How do you write animals so well?
Well, probably pulling a little bit from my veterinary background. You know, I did a lot of, you know, survey on, you know, animal husbandry and animal behavior, and so I have some roots in that. But I also, just as a general interest, I read up a bunch of information on different species. And I've been fascinated by gorillas, you know, going back to, you know Diane Fossey and Jane Goodall and all the research being done with the great apes. I'm also fascinated by the fact that we're sort of at a turning point in regards to great ape research here in the U.S. Right now, we're one of the few Western countries that allows research to be done on great apes. Most other countries have banned them because of the level of intelligence and the fact that it's probably a certain level of cruelty involved in trying to keep these animals under such levels of captivity, isolation. You know, they basically go a little bit crazy. And so right now we're starting to see that tidal shift occurring in the U.S. government. The National Institute of Health right now have banned or discontinued the use of chimpanzees in research. They're beginning to find homes for all the different research animals out there. Matter of fact, where this book starts is at the Yerkes National Primate Center outside of Atlanta. And right now they're beginning to try to find homes for the chimpanzees at that facility.
I had no idea. That's very interesting. I didn't know that we were really one of the only countries that does stuff with gorillas like that. I didn't know that. I thought that maybe some of the African ones would do something like that too. Interesting.
There are some countries that still do it, but most of the Western countries, New Zealand, Australia, all have bans in place for doing research on great apes.
So now that you're book 11 here in the Sigma 4 series, and as you continue to keep writing the series, do you challenge yourself in a certain way? So when you sit down to kind of write a book, you're like, okay, you know what? In this book, I'm going to do something a little different to kind of challenge myself to see if I can kind of get it done. And it might be something very subtle that the reader doesn't know, and it might be something big that the reader does recognize. Is there something like that in the Bone Labyrinth that maybe the reader will or will not recognize that, you know, you are challenging yourself as an author to do something maybe a little different or evolve in a different kind of way with your stories?
Yeah, I mean, well, I think as a writer, unless you do challenge yourself, you do try to push yourself, push those boundaries. And people often ask me the question, you know, what's the best information, what's the best advice you can give to a writer, someone that's trying to get published or just beginning their career. And I always tell them, it's the old adage, you should write every day. But I also add a little caveat to that is you should be reading every night. In that, whatever trouble you're having during your writing day, whether it's doing dialogue or setting up description or whatever that problem happens to be, it forms a little knot in your head during the day because you've been struggling with it during your writing days, the pages you've been working on. But at night, as you're reading a novel, oftentimes you're going to find that knot beginning to unwind because as you're being taught by example of a writer being, demonstrating how they're handling that dialogue or that description. And I still avidly read. I read voraciously, and I'm still to this day doing that. I'm writing every day and reading every night, and I'm seeing some things that other authors are doing. I thought, oh, that's cool. I'm going to try to do that. And so I always, almost every one of my novels, I'll set out to try to do something a little bit different. In this case, it was more challenging to try to write from a gorilla's point of view. But again, I have done that before. I introduced a military war dog named Kane that has appeared in some short stories and in one of the Sigma series and also in his own standalone novel. So I've sort of broached the subject of writing from the point of view of an animal in my books. Again, it's a little more challenging to go from this point, but I think part of the biggest challenge in this book that I wanted to try to pull out is that, Bako communicates mostly via sign language. And so my goal in this book was to try to incorporate sign language, which is a very visual type of language, and try to put that into print. And so that was a bit of a challenge to try to do that, try to find out how do you even write that. So it's very subtle. It's not a very big part of the story necessarily. It's critical, but not huge. But it was sort of fun trying to figure out how to, describe the hand signals, yet at the same time get the message across both visually and from a story standpoint.
You did a really nice job with it. I totally understood what you were doing. It was great. So with all these characters, they're so diverse, and with, the 11th book in the series, I'm curious, how do you keep track of each character and their arcs? Because you want each character to grow with each book. Do you have, an overall arc that you're shooting for with each character as the books progress?
I mean, no. I shouldn't say that I've got this huge, gigantic, multi-year, multi-decade plan for all of these characters. I'm growing up with them with the story, so a lot of it, the times I'm learning about these characters as much as my readers are. Even when it comes to writing my novels, I don't write from a very strict outline. I have to have some outline. I can't write necessarily from a totally blank page. I need to know the beginning and the end, a few stopping points in between, but I don't necessarily know how A connects to B connects to C. To me, one of the joys of writing is the discovery of that path. And the same with the characters. When you're talking about, a multi-book series, I resisted doing series, by the way, for a bit. All my early novels were standalone. I didn't really like the idea of a recurring character necessarily because it's what I call the Jessica Fletcher syndrome, where, Jessica Fletcher's always stumbling over dead bodies. I've never stumbled over a dead body. So the question is, why is she stumbling over a dead body so often? Eventually that strains the level of credibility, unless, you know, I always thought the very last episode of Murder, She Wrote should have been the revelation that Jessica Fletcher was a serial killer and that she's been framing everybody all along. And the series would make sense. But so, you know, when I was building a series, I introduced Sigma Force in what I thought was a standalone novel, Sandstorm, and Sigma was not necessarily a huge player or a huge role in the book. There's a different set of main characters in that book. But I like that. I like this idea of these the field operatives for DARPA, these scientists with guns that go out to the field that protect U.S. interests and against global threats. And I thought, well, gosh, you know, maybe I can build a series around a group of characters rather than a single character. That way I have a cast of characters that I can sort of shine a different spotlight on different characters in different books. In this book, this basically came from the request of readers. I kept getting questions on the road. You know, Jim, you've had we've got a lot of backstory with Gray and with Sechon and with Monk and with Cat. But, you know, we don't really know much about Kowalski's backstory. Where does he come? How does he tick? And I realized, you know, I really haven't covered that in great detail. And so that was one of the things I wanted to do with this novel, was to turn that spotlight onto Kowalski. And besides writing from a gorilla's point of view, I thought I'm going to write from Kowalski's point of view. Now, that there's a whole lot of difference probably between a gorilla and Kowalski, but my challenge here was to bring that character's point of view onto the page so I can fill in some of his back history a bit, and we can sort of see how he ticks. And of course, you know, again, you know, writing a book based about Neanderthals, you know, what better book than that for Kowalski to make his big debut?
That's a good point. One of the things I love about your work is that you take different scientific ideas and sort of elaborate on them. And I'm wondering, has there ever been a subject you've started to write about and thought, well, this is something I don't believe, but then as you've been writing about it, you swayed yourself into believing it?
I would say that was with this book. Actually, I mean, it's probably happened in some aspects in other books, but I remember specifically with this book when I was dealing with the question about the moon. I don't want to really tell too much about it because there were some big surprises in this book. But there's some revelations about this moon, about the moon, and I'll just bring up this subject because I don't think it'll ruin too much. You know, I've never, here I am 50-plus years old. I don't mind admitting that. And I've gone through a few solar eclipses over my lifetime. But it never really struck me about how odd it was that during a total eclipse that the moon perfectly fits over the face of the sun. You know, just saying, well, it happens. It's part of nature. I never gave it much thought until, you know, I was reading up and doing some of the scientific research for this book, and you realize what an odd coincidence that was. You know, I have this quote at the back of the book from Isaac Asimov basically saying it's the most inexplicable coincidence of all time, the fact that the moon perfectly fits over the face of the sun. That only happens because the moon is 1/400th the size of the sun and sits 1/400th the distance between the sun and the moon, I mean, between the sun and the earth. Pretty strange coincidence. So the question, you know, me being the rational person is thinking, well, it's, you know, it is just coincidence. You know, coincidence happened, and why couldn't this be a coincidence? But then the more I was reading about this aspect and writing about this aspect, I'm thinking, oh my gosh, the moon's not real.
Interesting.
Didn't they say, isn't there somewhere I read that it sounds hollow like a bell when you hit it?
It was I tried to put that in the book, but I never really found a decent chance to put it in the book that when one of the, I think it was one of the boosters for one of the, during one of the manned, it might have been manned, might have been unmanned, but anyways, it crashed into the moon, and they recorded the sound of its crash, and the crash had a very strange sort of hollow ringing sound. And so there's some speculation that the moon, you know, further speculation that the moon might be an artificial structure.
Cool.
Huh. Well, I can see that. I mean, I think my ex-wife was an artificial structure, so we can say that too. So I know it can happen. So now the one thing that is out that just came out on November 3rd, you gave everybody a little taste, and this is something that's coming much more popular because with ebooks, you can do this because you can put out these short stories and these little novellas to kind of bridge people, which you like to call, this is the 10.5 book in the Sigma 4 series. It's called The Midnight Watch. And Kowalski is extremely important in this book. So what was kind of the backstory of why you decided to kind of to do it now and give us a little bit of taste about what is The Midnight Watch?
Well, partly it was just an experiment initially. That story was somewhat outlined out and was supposed to be somewhat of a part of this the novel itself, but never ended up there. But it was sort of my test vehicle for writing from Kowalski's point of view. Allowed me to fill in some details that never really is revealed in any of the novels. You know, one of the previous novels, Kowalski had a girlfriend. We knew from the last couple of books that that relationship ended, but we never didn't know any details behind that or how he recovered from that or how he was dealing with that. And so the short story gave me an opportunity to explore that a little bit, but also introduce some of the themes that are going to echo into the bigger novel. So it's sort of a gateway drug for the big book. And so again, the gist of the story, too, is basically there's a it's a very short time frame. It all occurs literally during the midnight watch. There is a cyber attack on U.S. systems that shuts things down, and it leads to Sigma Force being sort of mobilized, and Kowalski's the only one still hanging around. And so he's tapped to go ahead and try to stop what's happening.
And so kind of like with ebooks and with the ability to be able to do this and have these kind of side projects, because of course, you know, 20 to 30 years ago, this would have never been able to happen. You either would have had to fix it and try to put it into the book, or it just would have been something that's left out. So do you maybe see yourself doing this a little bit more with stories that you think that you want to tell that are maybe better as a short story aspect than a full novel?
Yeah, it's sort of nice in that, a lot of times I have ideas that I want to explore but aren't necessarily big enough to be a tentpole for a novel, yet they're so intriguing that I want to tackle them, and the short story is a perfect vehicle to do that. So I've got a whole list of things that I, you know, down the line, if I want to do a short story, I know what I want to sort of tackle with. And I've done it before. I've done a few of these, and they're enjoyable. It allows me to sort of get my feet wet when it comes to some of the – usually they somehow tie into whatever novel that they're pre-released toward. And so it allows me to sort of explore some of the themes before I sort of write that big novel. So they're enjoyable. They're fun. They work well as a vehicle for people that maybe have never, you know, read a James Rollins novel. Don't want to necessarily commit to the 500 to 600-page, doorstop of a novel, but maybe pick up the short story and spend, 20, 30 minutes reading it and sort of get a gist of how my mind ticks.
Do you have plans to collect all of these into a giant short story collection?
You know, my agent has mentioned that before. I don't have any firm plans for that at this point, but that's something we've talked about down the line. Because a couple short stories that I'm really proud of that have appeared a while ago, and so they sort of fade into the background. I wrote a short story for George R. R. Martin's anthology called Warriors, where I got to write from the point of view of a pit bull in a pit bull fighting organization, and so I did a bunch of research in that organization. It's one of the works I'm most proud of, and people that I have stumbled upon it. It's really moving, and it'd be nice to be able to get that in front of more eyeballs.
Oh, absolutely. Maybe you should release it as an ebook short or something as well.
Yeah, we may do that down the line. At this point, it has. I can do that. The book's been out long enough that that's definitely something that's I'll probably consider.
Right.
Yeah. One of the things I have to ask, since having read Bone Labyrinth, I'm one of the lucky ones who got to read it early. There's a gap at the end between the last chapter and the epilogue,
yep.
And I'm just kind of wondering, are you going to be addressing that in the future without trying to give too much away?
Yes, there is there's a little gap there, and there is a little mystery that's set up within the pages of that epilogue. You're not the first one who knocked on my door, called me, and said, did you mean by this? And
yes, clarification
will come fairly quickly.
Okay.
You know, and I guess that's kind of the author's way of just having a little fun with his reader, right? I mean, that's something that you can just kind of do and say, ha, 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 now you got to wait.
I mean, it's not germane necessarily to the plot of the story. It's just a tangential element to the story that is going to raise a few eyebrows.
Gotcha.
It was neat. It was neat.
Now, of course, and I know you've been asked this question hundreds of times, so I apologize, but it's just always something that a lot of people always like to know because it always comes up and you always have new readers. You know, thank God we have new readers to keep coming up. Otherwise, this is not really going to last that long, I guess, what we're doing. But when people come up and they see that you're now in the 11th book of the series, and then they say, oh, you know, should I start at the beginning or should I start, you know, with 11? You know, how can I do? How do you always answer that question with them?
Well, I usually tell them you can start. Each book is structured in such a way that you can read them in any order. They're all self-contained, so that any backstory is usually fed into the novel and flowed in. So I would say 90% of my readers have not read The Sigma Force in order. They've hopped onto whatever book happens to be out at that time. If they enjoyed it, which hopefully they do, then they fill in the backstory from there. You know, just as a timeline, you know, I always consider Sandstorm sort of the prequel to the series, Map of Bones being the first book in the series, and then onward from there. But you definitely do not need to read it in order. Yeah, you probably get some bigger arc of character development over the course of that if you read it in order. But ultimately, you know, you can pick up any of these books at any point and fully enjoy the story.
Gotcha.
Curious about film and TV. This whole premise would be so fantastic for a TV show or even a movie. I do remember hearing a while back that the movie rights were sold, but that producer passed away. Is there anything going on with that or not?
All I can say is I can't answer that. Somebody wants to announce it first, so I'm not allowed to say anything.
Oh, so
like
not
however you want. I did not officially announce anything.
You didn't say nothing.
Okay, gotcha.
So we can all make our own determinations on what that means. I guess,
exactly.
It's
just like that little
to.
Line at the end of the epilogue of Bone Labyrinth. You know. Just teasing you.
Now, I'm going to ask this all.
There's an iron in the fire, and the iron is... quite
well, that would be great. So we'll have to wait. Now I guess we'll have to wait and see whoever wants to announce that first, that your books are going to be a movie. So that would be a good thing. I'll say it. Hey, that's the determination I'm making out of this one, people. That's all I'm going to say. So we kind of talked just a little off the air because, you know, you do have some new things coming up. Of course, you have a new book coming out. You have two next year. You're going to have the first one's going to be in April that you're co-authoring with Grant Blackwood called Warhawk.
Warhawk, yep.
And so you have, you know, just finished your trilogy with Rebecca Cantrell. So is this series, Warhawk, going forward, which is a Tucker Wayne novel, is this going to be something that's going to go on in the future, or is this a set amount of books like you had with Rebecca?
No, Tucker series is more open-ended. You know, again, it's the series with Rebecca was envisioned as a three-book arc. You know, it was pretty much, I consider those three books to be almost just one big novel broken into three pieces, whereas the Tucker Wayne books are more standalone-ish in that, again, you can probably read them in any order, and so it's more of a recurring character type of situation. And so you'll probably see a Tucker Wayne book, maybe not every year, but you know, probably every other year.
Okay.
What's the next Sigma novel called?
Yeah, the next Sigma one?
I can't tell you the name.
Oh.
Not that it's a big secret. It's that there's three titles being bandied about right now, so I don't know what's going to be settled on.
Okay.
But it's going to be about this same time next year, right? This is like the
yes.
time?
Yep.
Okay.
Cool.
Well, I'll tell you what, James, we want to thank you so much for coming on. It's been absolutely fabulous to be able to speak with you and to get some of this insight and some mystery within the interview, which we can always speculate on what's going to happen with that. So, you know, we want to thank you so much for coming on, and it's been such a pleasure.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
All right.
It was fun, and good luck.
Yeah, and stay warm up there in Sacramento, because I'll tell you what, we are freezing our butts off down here, and I know that you're freezing your butt off up there. So I don't know about this whole El Nino thing, but so far it's brought cold weather but no rain. So I haven't got any rain.
Definitely need the rain.
I'm just telling.
Rain.
Oh. Rain, and we need snow, and we got a little bit up there in that snowpack, but we need a lot more than that to keep us going. All right. Have a good one, James. Thanks again.
You're most welcome. Thank you.
Take care. Thanks again.
All right. Bye-bye. So, again, everybody, that is New York Times bestselling author James Rollins talking about his latest book, The Bone Labyrinth. It is the 11th book in the Sigma Force novel series that James has going on. I mean, it's a blockbuster, to say the least, I would say, Jeff, right?
Oh, it's wonderful. Loved it.
I mean, I have not read all of the Sigma Force series books, so, you know, I kind of skipped around because, I mean, there's just so much. But have you read all of them?
I have, and I'm obviously a huge fan, so it's a thrill to get to talk to James. But this
so
new
I guess,
one
I guess the question
is really
is,
good.
How would you rank this one with the other 10?
I would say it's different, but in a good way. How's that being
okay.
Vague?
That's about as vague as if he has a book coming out that's a movie.
Well, we all have to be mysterious now and then.
But, I mean, in the line, you think that hardcore fans or just regular casual fans of this book are going to like it?
I think that he wrote a book that the fans will love, and people who've not read the series before will pick this up and really be compelled to pick up the others, which is
gotcha.
What you want.
And that is what you want. Well, why don't we take a quick break, and we're going to get our other guest here, Douglas Schofield, on the line, and we're going to talk with him. And so why don't we be back in about 3 minutes, all right?
Sounds good.
Here we go.
Life's the same, except for my shoes.
everybody, and welcome back to the break. And tell me, of course, that whenever you hear that song, you don't immediately think of Fast Times at Ridgemont High and the Phoebe Cates scene, because I sure do, which is why I like to play it on certain occasions. So,
happy Thanksgiving, everybody.
Happy Thanksgiving and Merry Christmas. So, and Chevy Chase almost does a scene like that in Christmas Vacation. But that's, so we, again, we want to thank James Rollins for coming on. It was great to have him. But we're going to now jump into our next guest. He is author Douglas Schofield. His latest book is called Time of Departure. You can go to douglasschofield.com for more information on him and everything that he's got going on. So, Douglas, thanks so much for joining us tonight. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. Thank you. And hello to everyone from the sunny Caribbean.
Oh, boy, I like the way you rub that one in. Yeah, but that's, you know, that's okay. We're sunny pretty much 11 months out of the year. It's just we get those crappy, you know, days, which is we're having now. But it's sunny during the day. It's just a little chilly down in L.A. We're just not used to that. So no bikinis for us like you are down in the Bahamas. But that's,
well,
know,
we're coming
we
out to California for Christmas, so we'll get a taste of it.
Oh, good. Yeah, we'll turn the air on for you so it's nice and cold. Yeah. So let's just jump right into it, because your latest book is called Time of Departure. And so it's just like it kind of reads, it kind of says it's a fictional equivalent of a carefully crafted set of Chinese boxes. Now, when I see that with one of the reviewers who read that, Les Stanford, that's one of the most intriguing kind of things I think I've ever seen in a review for a book. So give us a little bit about what you got going on in this one.
Well, this one is, I think, one of my other friends, James Renner, you know, the author, calls a genre bender. I'd never heard that phrase before. He wrote one of the blurbs for it, and mm-hmm. he said you can expect an unusual reaction from some people who suddenly realize that this isn't the book they thought they bought. But I understand, Jeff, you liked it.
Well, I loved it. I thought it was fantastic, and that was one of the reasons why I was telling John, we got to get you on the show.
Yeah, I have not had a chance to read it yet, so I do apologize for that, but I will get to it.
I'll make sure he does, so...
Yeah, he'll hit me over the head.
Without giving too much away, can you talk a bit about the book?
Yeah.
Well, it's a story about a prosecutor, and I have spent many years being a prosecutor, but not in your country. I was a prosecutor in Canada, Bermuda, and the Cayman Islands briefly before I switched to civil law. So I have a lot of experience as what we call a crown prosecutor. But I wanted to set this in Florida, so I had to draw on a lot of my friends in U.S. law enforcement and in the legal profession. Unfortunately, I know a number of fine lawyers and very, very fascinating police officers in your country. So I was able to start it out as a police procedural, but through the eyes of a female prosecutor, in Gainesville, Florida. I just picked Gainesville because I happen to like North Central Florida. It's kind of spooky. And it just, one thing led to another. This is the development, actually, of an earlier story that I had planned that I never wrote. So, but it's a story that halfway through turns into something else. And some of the reviewers have already sort of given it away. But it's
just
basically a... Yeah, it is a story. It was my own fault. You don't put the twist in the middle. But the editors liked it. Macmillan's liked it, and so I'm not complaining. Actually, when I got a phone call from my editor in New York originally about this, I said to her, I'm a little surprised you actually grabbed this so quickly, because of what happens in the middle. And she said, oh, but it doesn't matter. It all works in the world of this story. I loved it. And so I'm not complaining.
Well, I have to ask, how did you make all the pieces fit? Being as vague as possible here, because there's so many elements you throw out initially, and it all has to fit together at the end, and it does. How did you do that?
That was a lot of work. But I did I had a dry run. I should tell you that this story, first of all, this story, I dreamed this story up when I worked in Bermuda, and that's another whole story about how it came about, but it was a different kind of story. It involved a young woman who lived in the 1970s and a man who lived during World War II. But I never developed that story farther than an outline. This time, I started out as a screenplay. I know how to write screenplays. I've taken a course in it, and I've had some contact in Hollywood and that kind of thing. And I actually entered it as a screenplay 10 years ago in a contest in L.A., and it won for its genre, if you can call that a genre.
Nice.
It won. It took first prize. But I had some interest. I had a well-known producer trying to get financing for it. He wanted to make it into a film, and it never actually happened. And so I decided, well, while I'm waiting, why don't I turn it into a novel? So I'd already had a dry run of putting the pieces together. But that said, it took me and my wife, with some help from my wife, believe me, about 18 months to make sure that there weren't flaws. We did a draft. I did a draft. My wife read it. She pointed things out. It was a lot of work, but it was a lot of fun. And I think it came together.
I can tell it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was. It's so unusual, really, when you think about it.
And for an author, when you're writing a book like this, and you kind of go through, and like you said, it kind of took you so long to kind of do it, but then you end up seeing the finished product. How much different was it at the beginning to the end when it was finally finished? I mean, did you cut stuff out? Did you add stuff? I mean, what was how was the progression from beginning to end, and what did it look like?
Actually, there was a lot of tweaking. I had the story arc organized. I had an outline which got – actually, it started out as a short outline, and the outline got longer and longer and longer. And the outline became the novel. It's different. Every other book I've written an outline, and then I've written a novel. But this is one where the outline was so important that it became ultimately, it grew organically and became the novel. It was a strange experience to write this novel. And the other thing is that after a while, I almost felt like I was Claire, and I realized I'm writing about a different gender, but I had myself in so far inside that woman's head at some point writing this book that I was able to imagine exactly how she must have felt at different stages as best I could. And then, of course, I ran the draft past a lot of women proofreaders because I needed feedback from women, and it seemed to work. So
I don't know if
I explained myself. Sorry.
Why a woman character instead of a male character, I guess?
Well, if you've seen the other things I've written, I always write female, and I've just written another one. I've just finished another one for the publisher. It's in draft. And it's also a woman protagonist. I think it's because there are so many novels and so much of Hollywood featuring men as protagonists. It's always the male hero. I don't know. I just thought, why couldn't women do some of these things, take the lead in some of these stories? In fact, that's a trend that's suddenly broken out in Hollywood, I read recently. But in any event, it's just my thing. I'd rather create a female hero. There were women during World War II that worked behind the lines, at risk of being tortured and raped and murdered by the Gestapo for years. And they are the unsung heroes of World War II because all you ever read about are the male spies. There were some amazing women, and I've read a lot of books about them, and that sort of, I don't know, it sort of embedded itself in my psyche that I think that there should be more women heroes in fiction. And so that's just my thing.
Well, one of the things that you bring up, because one of the biggest mysteries here in the U.S., and I'm not sure if you know, is, of course, during the Revolutionary War, George Washington had a ring of spies. And pretty much all the spies have been named, except there is one that is only listed as a number. And a lot of people speculate that that is a woman, but they don't really know who. But, of course, Brad Meltzer is a big person who, you know, trying to find this out, and a lot of other historians trying to find this out. So, you know, I think a lot of women that might have done things in the past were maybe put on the back burner for that simple reason, because, heck, they couldn't even vote, I mean, 100 years ago. And so yeah. Now when you're bringing them to the forefront in books and things, it kind of does show, and I see a lot of authors, like John Land, his character his main character is a woman, and you see a lot more males writing women like this, because I think it leads to a lot of intrigue and a lot of fun for the author to kind of step out of that zone of the male-dominated thing and kind of do a female.
Well, we see eye to eye on that, definitely.
Yeah.
And I'm quite interested. I'd never heard that about Washington having
he had a ring of spies in the Revolutionary War, and I forget the number, but it's like Agent 77 or 66 or something, that's only written down as that number. And some people have speculated, is it Betsy Ross or was it somebody else? But a lot of people think that that's a woman. And that's why even she's never mentioned, because it would be too very taboo if it was a woman. And so it was just a number. So that's just the speculation.
His group of spies was called the Culver Ring.
Yes. The Cobra Ring, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, there's a novel in that.
There is. And I think a lot of historical fiction people have done that. But when you kind of step yourself out, because now this is, you know, your third book, Time of Departure, is out now, and they're all standalones, and there's not going to be the path that you kind of take going forward. Are you going to not maybe have that series? You're just going to continue to just kind of maybe have these standalone books of just these one-off ideas that are going to keep going forward?
Well, no, actually, but of course I'm in the hands of my publisher. I'm very grateful to Macmillan to have taken me aboard, and obviously I will take the lead indicated by my editor as what they think is best. But I already have mapped out two sequels to one of my earlier books, and one sequel to the other one. And if I ever get a chance to, for example, reissue one of them, then I will go ahead with the sequels. And then there would be a protagonist that lasted through more than one novel. But the next one, the one I've just written, which, you know, is not yet ready for prime time, it is also a female protagonist, and it's also a standalone. But that was by agreement with my publisher, so...
Well, your first two books are available as ebooks, and I'm wondering if you could talk a bit about them. And obviously, this new book is not going to be a series. We'll just throw that out there. That doesn't spoil anything.
No, that doesn't spoil it.
Could you talk a bit about your first two books?
Well, my very first book, Flight Risks. First of all, Flight Risks and Succession, which are my first two books, were both published by a small house in England, and they never got a lot of exposure. They were in print, but really only circulated within the United Kingdom, and they are available as ebooks, as you know, in North America. The first one, Flight Risk, is takes place during 9/11, and it's about a legal secretary who gets caught up in. In a sense, she's caught up in 9/11 because she works in a law firm where she stumbles on a plot to finance these characters who are these jihadists who are involved in this in 9/11 and something similar, which is being planned, which I dreamed up. She gets drawn into something which takes her right across North America. She's being pursued not only by the police, but also by bad guys, I'll put it that way. The story comes all the way here to the Cayman Islands and ends up back in British Columbia. it goes through, it involves all three countries, Canada, United States, mainly Louisiana and Florida, and the Cayman Islands. My second book, Succession, is about a doctor in the United States, who, in Bayonne, New Jersey, actually, a young female resident surgeon who, I don't know how to not give this one away, but she is actually the true heir to the British throne. She has no idea. That's about all I want to say. And that is a planned 3-book series, but only Succession has been published, and the other two are in outline.
Why, as someone with a legal background, are you writing stuff like that as opposed to writing about what you know, basically legal thrillers?
Well, in many ways, what I know comes into these stories. But instead of having the lawyer hero, I decided, why not a legal secretary who finds out more and she's bright, she's smart, she doesn't have a law degree, but she knows a way around a law office and a courtroom. Why not have the heroine as a legal secretary? So there is a legal background to the first book. The second one, I decided to make her a doctor, and I have lots of – I was a lawyer for the hospital here for years, so I have a lot of doctor friends to help me with the technical stuff. And I guess the third point is this. My first degree was in history, and you can find a story in anything. Just I have a library of books all the way back to the Middle Ages. I've got so many books, history books, that I can go back to them and reread them, and I'll suddenly get an idea for a story. So it doesn't have to be law just because I've practiced law, and I really do not want to write courtroom drama all the time just because I was a lawyer. I want to be broader than that.
Right. No, that's a good thing, actually.
Right.
Why, though, I'm curious, what makes attorneys such good storytellers?
Well, first of all,
I can answer that. Because, I mean, you have to, especially if you're defending somebody, you have to tell a funny story to try to get them off, because otherwise it just ain't going to happen. That's just the way it goes. You just got to go in there and tell them stories, right? You got to get them thinking about something else. I don't know. I'm just kind of throwing that out there. That's kind of a stupid answer.
No. You're absolutely right. You know what? If you're a lawyer, especially a defense lawyer, now I was mainly a prosecutor, but I've done many, many years of defense work as well. You have to control the narrative. If you want to win your case, you have to control the narrative. So maybe that's why you spend a few decades doing that in front of juries. And, the old story about lawyers are probably the best fiction writers in their own profession, much less as novelists. Control the narrative. Maybe that's it. Yeah.
So now, when you're sitting down and you're starting to outline a book, the big debate goes on, of course, is it plot? Is it character? And those kinds of things that are driving the story. Do you consciously make a decision to say, I'm going to have this more of a character book, I'm going to have this more of a plot book? Or do you not even think about that and it just kind of unfolds as it unfolds?
It's the latter. I don't think about that, actually. No. If anything, I lean more towards plot anyway, because you want to make all the pieces come together. But I don't consciously, I don't focus on that. And you can take these courses for example, Les Standiford teaches courses like this. He's the fellow you quoted at the beginning of our little talk here. Les has written novels and nonfiction, and he teaches courses that, I've never taken any of his courses, by the way, but where people focus on whether they want a character-driven story or a plot-driven story. Hollywood always talks about character-driven or plot-driven, but when you're writing, I'm not really concentrating on that at all. I'm sort of in a zone. I know that sounds like a cliche, but I get into sort of a zone. And at the end of the day, I'm astonished by what I produced or disappointed, but it is not the product of that kind of analysis. Does that help?
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah, and it is. It's just one of those things that a lot of people talk about in today's day and age with is the plot versus the character and how books are being constructed, I think, more. And I don't think there's any wrong way, but I think it's just like an author's choice. And, you know, and so I just kind of, you know, was just kind of curious to see maybe, you know, your thought process. Because we have a lot of young authors and a lot of people who want to be authors that kind of listen to the show because they like to hear, you know, maybe like your story and kind of how those things work out. And I think that they like to understand maybe the best kind of way for them to approach a blank canvas and make it work, because that's a very difficult thing to have to do.
It is indeed. It is indeed. And it's a process I don't even understand in myself.
Yeah.
That's right.
Sometimes you either got it or you don't, I guess, is the way it comes down to sometimes.
Maybe.
What prompted you to even start thinking about writing? You had a job that had to be consuming. What prompted you to do this, and how did you find time to actually do the writing?
Well, finding time, that was has always been a problem. But I must say what prompted me, there's only one reason I ever completed my first novel, which was half written, when I met her, and that is my wife. My wife is the driving force that got me to complete my first novel and prove to myself I could write a novel. And then it was published. I mean, it wasn't published to the great fanfare by a major house, but it was published. And the print edition, because I actually changed publishers, went through three editions. But we're talking about small print runs. We're not talking about a big bestseller. But it was my wife who was just determined that I would finish that novel. And then when you prove to yourself you can write a novel, well then, if you've got a fertile mind at all, you want to write another one. Maybe it's a little bit addictive.
I would agree with that.
I enjoy writing screenplays. I learned how to write screenplays in the early 2000s. I actually went to a course and sat for 3 days next to Drew Barrymore, which was kind of fun, because she is a great lady and she's a lot of fun. But it was nice to be there with people like that in L.A. and take that course, and then to win that prize. That was really an encouragement as well. And you learn a lot from screenwriting. You learn a lot about spare language, economy of language, and how to write dialogue. The toughest thing is dialogue.
Yeah, I think what makes it so difficult is making sure that every character doesn't sound the same and they all have their little uniqueness. So when people are reading it, you don't really have to say Henry said or Catherine said, or people already kind of know from what they're saying and how they're saying it.
That's right. Absolutely right. And
yeah.
Different people have different ways of speaking. But one of the rules, I think, of novel writing is I've done it in this book to a slight degree, but don't try to write in dialect, in patois, in accent. Don't try to put on the page. Write it in plain English, but make sure what the words are reveal your character's background. You know what I'm talking about, don't you?
Yeah. Yeah, I got you. Yeah, without a doubt.
It's the
I
way
understand.
You put the word. But people who try to write in accent, it makes it too hard to read. It's hard on the reader.
It does. Yeah, I mean, I guess the only way that I've ever seen it done correctly is maybe some of that Southern twang stuff. I think Stephen King kind of does that in some of his books.
That's right.
Where he kind of has a character that kind of does it. But it's only one character, so it's not overblown. So he might have one character maybe doing it that way. And, I'm just going to throw it out because it's on top of my head, like The Stand, where the guy would always say, you know, M-O-O-N, that spells moon, that spells whatever it is, and that's what he always said. And, you know, he's very good at doing those kinds of things.
He is.
But it's not easy. Yeah, it's not easy. Well, I'll tell you, Douglas, we want to kind of give you the last word to kind of let everybody know where they can find out about you, besides maybe your website, you know, any of your social media, the stuff that you got going on. So we want to let you kind of let everybody know what's happening.
Well, I've got my website, as you've already mentioned, and on my website is my Facebook page. But I have two Facebook pages. I have a private one, and you know, for all my friends, and then I have that one. But other than that, you know, frankly, I'm relying on an amazing guy in New York who seems to know everybody and seems to be able to get this book into everybody's hands. And so I tip my hat to him, and I think you know who I'm talking about.
Oh, I know exactly who you're talking about. Yep.
I don't know who you're talking about.
Well, he's the person I coordinated to get you on the show tonight, so yes.
Right. Okay, good. Okay.
I'm not a big high-tech sort of social media guy, and, you know, if I was 30 years younger, so, you know, the best I can do is Skype.
Yeah. Hey, I get that. Well, again, yeah. Douglas, we want to thank you for coming on. It's been fabulous to talk with you, and you know, wish you nothing but the best. Can't wait to see what you got coming up next. And it sounds like you got a lot of work going on. Of course, a lot of self-imposed work that you're going to have going on, but a lot of work nevertheless.
No, that's right, because actually I've just been drawn into a huge lawsuit here, which involves me going back and forth to London, so it's going to cut into my writing time. I'm involved as counsel, not as the defendant. But, I'm going to keep at it. I really like this. And I'd really rather talk to guys like you than a jury.
Yeah. A lot of
Well,
people
we'll have
to
have you on when
it.
The next book comes out.
It's funny because I think a lot of people would rather talk to a jury than to talk to me. But screw it. They got me instead. And that's just the way it goes.
I'll plead the fifth on that one.
Yeah. And you know what? And that's true. But Jeff asked to do the show with me, so he can't say too much. But there's not a lot of us around that are covering books the way that we cover them. So if they want to cover, they got to come to us so we can kind of do what we want. So that's what we do. We have fun.
This has been fun. So I hope I can talk to you guys again when the next one comes out.
Absolutely, Doug. We want to thank you so much for coming on. Enjoy the weather. Have fun down there. And we will talk with you soon. So stay in touch.
All right, I will, and thank you. And thank
you
for
the
kind words. Yeah.
Yes, no problem. So, again, everybody, that is author Douglas Schofield, and you can check him out at douglasschofield.com, and you can see his new book, A Time of Departure. So, Jeff, we want to thank James Rollins, of course, for coming on, and it's been a great one. We are going to have next in 2 weeks, it's going to be our last show. It's going to not really be live. We have two great authors that we have recorded in Craig Johnson and Robert Crace, and we are going to play those interviews for you in 2 weeks, and then we'll be off for the year, and we won't be back until 2016.
Oh, my goodness. So, can't believe the year's gone by so quickly.
I know. Another year older. Wow. My body feels tired. My knees hurt. My back hurts. Everything hurts, and I'm going to start taking Cialis for daily use in about 3 years, and that's where my life's headed, so that's okay. All right, everybody. And on that note, happy Thanksgiving. Have a happy holiday. And we will see you all again in 2 weeks for Craig Johnson and Robert Crace. See you later, Jeff. Have a good one.
You too. Good night.
All right. Good night.